out low, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Why Theory. As always, I am your host, Ryan Engley, joined, as always, by co-host Todd McGowan. Todd, how you doing, buddy?
Ryan, I'm doing great today. How are you?
I am, well, you know what? Things are, my college made the news, international news, for some reasons I do not support.
Yes.
I would hope that people, I can't really get into too much detail on certain things because it's very clear that there is a, it's very clear there's a side there's a side which my school is endorsing certain actions, political, but and also non, and also being very vindictive and prosecutory.
But let's just be clear, Ryan, because you're not, it's not your lack of courage, is that you don't want to contribute to the, I just learned this word, doxing of the,
yeah,
of the students, correct?
Genuinely true. Yeah, yes. Yeah. So yeah. I'll just in case you don't know what I'm talking about, I mean, you can look it up online. My college, there, so I have been, because Todd and I have rich lives. you know what? That's not true. This is the best thing that Todd and I get to, this is just true. This is the best thing that we get to do every month. So we don't have lives richer than these conversations, yes. But also outside of this stuff, I do other things that that way we just don't end up talking about. And one of the things that that I do is I help support particularly emotionally, but also intellectually and actually students who are involved in the protest movement on campus here, because they I don't want to say one way or the other if they're my students or not, because I could identify them, but they're just students I know. And so I wasn't sure how much I was going to talk about. So this is kind of the issue, is that like it's hard for me to talk about this without getting like very emotional. What my school did, and because whenever someone does something at this school and it happens to all the students, it is done. It's done in my name. You know what I mean? So like I don't support it, but it has to be we. You know. So what we did was. Planned, as faculty found out this week, there was a plan in place, to the details to which not really clear to all of us. But there was a plan that if a student protest got out of hand, there was a plan to bring in the police and what the way to disrupt it. And what happened was that it wasn't just like your local cops; it was 30 riot gear clad cops descending on to our the campus here, very, very close to my house. I saw the whole thing happen, and I was with people outside watching, and I went to the police station afterwards to support the students who had been taken.
They were protesting the war.
Yeah. So it was pro-Palestinian, but I mean, I actually, that's the way that it's been reported, like everywhere. And I think it like just to add a little bit of a detail that is not in the reporting that I've seen. Our president's letter often gets used as an objective accounting of what occurred. I talked about this for much longer than I plan on talking about on this podcast, but I don't want to give so much on this because, again, I don't want to identify any more students that have already been identified because of their involvement in what happened. I don't have tenure, so some of these some of these things aren't the most kind of protected statements. But I'll just say this.
That means you can act courageously, whereas a fool like me cannot.
Right? I appreciate you saying it like that. So I'll say this in a public document. What we faculty have learned since then is that I think that there was an aspect to this that I find deeply uncomfortable with and disturbing. Arresting students to solve what they want. Is the school to disclose its investments, because Pomona is a moneyed institution, and it refuses to have a conversation about our investments. This is just where we ended up in this particular situation. When you force people to yell to be heard, you kind of get what you get. And then what we learned is that what we had was a solution to the problem that was prepared. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
And that that makes me very, very deeply uncomfortable. So I and I'll just say this for my involvement is that I am somewhat responsible for there would have been two more students arrested if it wasn't for some things that I have done and said. So we'll put it that way.
Okay.
Which doesn't feel like enough, and it also feels like. So that's just sort of that's where we're at. That's where we're at. That's how I'm doing. Well, you ask how I'm doing, and I have this thing, and I got to answer the question.
You know, I don't think it's actually an infelicitous opening, because Lacan begins seminar 11.
Nice.
So
nice.
Things have happened. Things have happened to him. So he was giving a seminar on Le Nom du Père, the names of the father, the name of the father, not plural, but even though sometimes he does say it plural, but just the name of the father. And that seminar was interrupted because he was basically thrown out of his space at St. Anne, L'Hôpital St. Anne. Mm-hmm. And he was at the same time thrown out of this larger French psychoanalytic organization, which in order to remain in the IPA, which is the International Psychoanalytical Association, they had to jettison him. And it wasn't doctrinaire. It was practical. Mm-hmm. It was because of his practice of the short session. That's why he got jettisoned. And they thought that you have to observe the 50-minute session. If you don't, you're gone. And so he compares his fate to that of Spinoza, this very famous excommunication of Spinoza. It's called a cherem, and it's a excommunication. It's the most severe that Spinoza got. So it's an excommunication, and Lacan makes a big deal out of this, without the possibility of return. And as a very young Spinoza got this, so it's before he even wrote the Tractatus, and let alone the Ethics. So he hadn't really written anything. So there's a whole industry of speculation about what exactly Spinoza did to get this excommunication from his Jewish congregation, the synagogue that he went to. And so he was in Netherlands. He was out of that, he couldn't go to any synagogue after this excommunication. And so Lacan, he identifies himself with Spinoza and with this excommunication. And what is really interesting, I think, and I think it's, again, I think speaks to the experience you've just recounted, is that, so one of the questions he has at the beginning of the seminar is, what authorizes me to speak, right? Is it that author? And I think there's been a whole lot of people saying, well, what authorizes the analyst to speak is the empirical experience of analysis. And Lacan is sufficient a philosopher to find that unacceptable, because it's an empirical thing that can't be the authorization. So I think what he's saying is, it's actually this act of excommunication that's putting him on the outside in this position of what I would call, let's say, non-belonging, that in my jargon. But I think that I think is for him, that gives him this perspective on the things that are going to be these fundamental concepts of psychoanalysis. One of the things we're going to do is say, Lacan doesn't exactly know what his own four fundamental concepts of psychoanalysis are. Like, he has, like, not just that he gets them wrong, but that he actually doesn't say what he's most focused on in this seminar. So it's a very weird thing, I think. But I do think it's important that he begins with this excommunication. And Miller entitles, we said this before, all the titles from every section, everything comes from Jacques-Alain Miller, not from Lacan himself. The title of the seminar, however, is Lacan's. And I think it's important that excommunication is the first section, right? Because it sets him up as this figure of externality or exclusion that then is able to see what's going on with the starting point was subjectivity, I think.
Mm. Yeah. No, I think this is great. And I appreciate a deft job of bringing us to the top. Today, we are talking about Lacan Seminar 11 and the four fundamental concepts of psychoanalysis. And we have, this is part of our reading. So his four fundamental concepts are as follows. The unconscious, repetition, transference, and drive.
Yeah.
We're going to change that a little bit because our reading, I think this is more clarifying to think. The four fundamental concepts of the four fundamental concepts are subjectivity, unconscious, the relationship between desire and drive, and objaya. And then this idea of starting with this idea of excommunication is that, like, what gives the authorization to speak is being exclusion. I want to say that the faculty did vote 70% to 30 to overturn what happened to the student, to the extent that I'm part of a majority here who feels this way, so there is that. We'll see how
aren't you occupying the position of the gap, right? Like, that's his,
it's an interesting point.
I think that's his idea, right?
That
subjectivity is located in the gap, and that's why he links it to causality and to ultimately to the objet-a, but subjectivity is precisely what occurs not just in the normal flow of signification, but in it's this interruption, it's this gap within signification. And I think that's what you are articulating that you and those fellow faculty members did.
Yeah, I agree, we'll restore normal's service and talking about film and whatnot. I'll get off this thing. It's been you'll just, as I hope everyone understands, been very preoccupying thing. As I imagine many aspects of this have been preoccupying for many people in many places. So on subjectivity, there's a nice line. To sum this up, is a very nice line on page 47 of the Norton translation. In order to understand the Freudian concepts, one must set out on the basis that it is the subject who is called the subject of Cartesian origin. This basis gives its true function to what in analysis is called recollection or remembering. Recollection is not Platonic reminiscence. It is not the return of a form, an imprint, a eidos. Is that eidos?
Yeah, eidos. Yeah,
eidos of beauty and good.
It's idea.
Okay. A supreme truth coming to us from beyond. It is something that comes to us from the structural necessities, something humble, born at the level of the lowest encounters and of all the talking crowd that precedes us, at the level of the structure of the signifier, of the languages spoken in a stuttering, stumbling way, but which cannot elude constraints whose echoes, model, and style can be found, curiously enough, in contemporary mathematics. So then he goes on and does that thing. But it is kind of, I think... we've been on this, this Lacan kick, and this is sort of the end of it for a bit now. And you've been, I would say, really forthcoming with something that is not published yet. Your take on Lacan's relationship with Kant and where he's Kantian and where he's not. So the last thing that we talked about, Seminar 7, is maybe the most Kantian.
Right.
That he is. And then here you've identified as this part, this Hegelian period, but it is interesting that he begins with subjectivity, which is like one of, as we talked about in the previous episodes, just something that, speaking of authorization, something that Kant authorizes as being the, at the center of philosophy is the subject. You know, and he wants to, so I think that's where you can do this, it's a really nice idea of this, seminar. I know that you have it, as a period beginning in with 9, is that right? Or
1960. Yeah. Sort of seminar 9. Yeah.
So you can see this, the way that, I mean, I suppose it's a real Hegelian way of including, of inclusion, like through, kind of a fulcrum of contradiction, which, you know, we'll get to exactly what that would mean. But just starting with the idea of subjectivity as just, this has to be the way that we think about psychoanalysis. And I mean, I think as he says, like psychoanalysis as a theoretical pursuit and as a clinical practice.
Right. I mean, this is the first time that he's not just talking to clinicians. So that's why this is a big deal, this seminar.
Yeah.
Like he's breaking out of his confine. He has a huge much larger audience than he's used to having. Mm. And so, yeah, you're exactly right. Like, he's thinking in theoretical terms, not, I mean, he always has, but I think here even more so. And he's really saying, look, psychoanalysis has something to say in this incredibly important philosophical question about subjectivity. That's what he's saying. Mm-hmm. This is as clear as can be about it, right? And he's saying Freud never once mentions, the German word is exactly the same, subject. He never once mentions it, right? Except if he's saying, like, this is the subject I'm talking about or something, right? Like, but he doesn't mention subjectivity as a philosophical idea. But Lacan certainly does. And I think that's a real, that seems to me like a real important step. And I think you're exactly right that it's because he, look, he doesn't think of himself as a philosopher. He resists that label. Mm-hmm. But I think he is comporting himself like a philosopher, which is why he wants to talk about subjectivity, right? And I think you're right. I mean, he's located, we talked about this before, he's locating it in Descartes. Descartes never uses the term subject, in French would be sujet, but he never uses it. It's Kant really is the inventor of the term. But mm-hmm. Descartes is certainly with the cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. He's definitely the inventor of modern subjectivity. I think there can be zero question about that. That as a, like, he's the figure. And so I think Lacan wants to return to him and then see this interesting, don't you think it's kind of fascinating, the parallel he sees between the role that doubt plays in Cartesian thought and the role that doubt plays for Freud and psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's part of what he's doing in the beginning of this seminar. He's saying, okay, for Descartes, how do I know that I am? Well, because I doubt. And that doubt, and that's the act of thinking. So doubting, you can almost translate Descartes to je doute, donc je suis. I doubt, and thus I am, right?
It's pretty good.
That seems just true to me. And he says about Freud, right? This thing about the dream, right? Like, what's the thing we can be most certain of in the dream, Freud says, when the patient goes, I'm not sure if that happened or not. I think it might not have happened. Freud's like, aha, that's the key. That's the kernel of the dream, right? The navel of the dream or whatever.
So,
right?
This is important because it's what he's, and it's, again, it's he's not saying this directly, but what's important here, I think, is he's showing, like, look, there's a philosophical history showing how important subjectivity is and how important, like, the doubt is, and we have the same thing in our practice. We have the same thing in what we call in the analytic method. Okay, right. in our clinics, and this is where you can almost see there's, like, kind of a backhanded defense of the short session here, which is like, should I not also be allowed to doubt the efficacy of the 50-minute thing?
Yeah.
You know, why should I believe? Why should I believe that's the appropriate length of time for it takes to do any of this? In fact, it makes people too comfortable. I mean, that's kind of his position.
Well, that's his point, right?
You know,
that's his
point. And that there needs to be these kind of radical, you know, interruptions. Now, I think there's a, like, you and I said this to each other, that it would be really, that sometimes someone, like a student will make a point that is, it's just, like, so great. And it's just, like,
yeah,
like it's excessive. It's like, it, you know, I mean, it exceeds, like, something that, like I'd be able to say, you know, and it would just be really great to be like, okay, class dismissed.
Yeah.
And that's, like, that sounds really cool, I think. And so then I guess, but where you run the problem is that, like, if you're doing that all the time, every week.
Especially if you started doing it after, like, 2 minutes of class. And that's basically what he started to do.
So
you were personally getting money from the students, and then you got it, started another class after the 2 minutes. Like, okay.
Right.
Then it's a little bit, it's how nice it sounds loses a little bit of it.
Exactly. We're just trying to interject to be fair, I guess. You know, of the thing. Yeah. But I do think the intellectual idea.
It's good.
It's solid. And it's definitely solid. And I think that that what he is pointing out and what he's trying to get at. I've written about this. I think in my piece for Continental Theory and Thought on seriality, and it's in my book manuscript as well, that he is trying to solve the problem of the end of analysis. That Freud first links directly to the serial in Studies in Hysteria, and of course we have the definitive judgment that this at the time, you know, other analysts didn't want this to be part of psychoanalysis as such, but wherever you are on the idea of the short session, I just think it is just, you cannot say that it's not an attempt to solve this problem that is intrinsic to the whole thing.
It's not crazy. No, I mean, like you're saying, anybody that's ever taught will completely attest to the fact that that would be a better way to rather than drone on for another. Okay, someone just made the great point, and then I'm going to drone on for another 10 minutes, right?
Yeah, like that just, right.
Yeah, it's just not as effective. Although, you know, I think there's arguments on both sides, but there is a clear theoretical justification for it. I mean, it's also ripe for abuse, as we don't need to go into that anymore. Yeah.
And the top level point, the thing that cuts through all of it though, is just the focus on subjectivity, on doubt, on like this, like how that what analysis does and what, like as a, it is like, we don't, you don't take someone at their word, it's that position is that the thing that you are most comfortable saying about yourself, that's the thing that we maybe need to pick at a little bit and start there.
Totally agree. And I think that isn't the point really even that the subjectivity, you use the word cut, like subjectivity is the cut. Right, like it is the rupture, it is the cut, and that's his point. I think that so there's a real link between short session and subject. Like in a certain way, that shortening of the session is forcing the subjectivity of the analysand or the patient to come out. I think that's the whole idea of it.
A cut session,
it'd be a nice cut session. Exactly. Yeah. Right, like coupé, un coupe. Like that's the word in French, and I think that's the idea. Right, like you're cutting. And then then of course there's the link between castration, right? Because in a way that's one of the ideas he'll get to later in the seminar, right? Is between like alienation is to recognize one's alienation is to recognize one's castration. Mm-hmm. And then to recognize the big other's castration is what he calls separation, right? So he's, mm-hmm. for Lacan, there's this two-step, right? And both of them involve castration. And I think, the danger of the short session is that it exposes the one and not the other, right? Like that it exposes the subject's own castration. But then you're like, wow, how did Lacan know just right when to end it? You know, like that. Like I think there is that danger that it actually to put it in a Hegelian jargon, like it substantializes the other, right? Like the other as the analyst is the other, right? Like it makes that other seem like, oh, wow, they really know what's going on. They knew exactly when to end the session. Whereas if the session keeps going, they're like, well, because the whole point is to get to the end of analysis and say, no, I was the one that knew. Like you go in supposing the subject, the other to know. And then you come away, you end when you're like, well, that fool didn't know. I knew the secret of my own symptom, right? So that's the, and I think that to get to that point, one has to go through this, what Lacan calls separation, which is this embrace of the other's castration. And so I wonder if maybe that's the, I don't know, I'm going to call it error of short session, you know, that which is again Lacan's practice that led to this very seminar, because that got him jettisoned from the larger psychoanalytic establishment.
So that's interesting. So are you, so that's a great point. So it's like I like this, because so what you have to take the underside, right? It's a nice Hegelian lesson. Is that de-substantializing the point of the position of the analyst as the, like, the sense maker, the meaning maker with this, which is what this short session does. And you know, of course, it is up to the analyst to decide when it ends in this manner, but it is the patient who speaks the speech that ends the session, right?
Right.
So you do this thing where you're like, no, like, what would be like a really like a very cliche, and this is not complicated enough, but I think it's a nice little introductory way to understand it would be the following cliche. It would be like, see, Todd, you had the knowledge inside you all along. You know, like, I mean, how many movies have you seen that in or whatever? Yeah. Okay, so what Lacan is doing more complicated than that. But, like, that is sort of the point, because one of the things, I mean, he does list transference as one of the fundamental concepts, so he doesn't talk about it so much in 11. And every more clinically minded person I know who reads this, they think, like, he doesn't even really talk about transference.
Well, he's talked about it 3 years earlier. So yeah, seminar 8's on, the whole seminar is on the transference.
Right.
Yeah, it's strange that he would even come back to it, right?
It is. But you can see what the, you know, again, he's trying to solve this problem where it's like you're trying to can you remove the analyst as subject supposed to know, and like how can we quicken this idea that, like, get past this idea that the analyst knows, the analyst is trained to pick up things that you would prefer to ignore. Okay.
Right.
And then in a, you know, negotiation, so to speak, or sometimes a hostile negotiation, we come to an understanding, a confrontation of what those things mean. And the thing that, you know, Lacan has this interest in solving, he wants to solve the issue of the end. He also wants to solve the issue of like, does this setup make the, like, you know, the analyst, the arbiter, like the sole arbiter of meaning? And then if we do that, then it's just like, again, it's this like really comfortable and like dialogue whereby the analyst has kind of like it's like where the analyst becomes like, they have all the responsibility of meaning, and then I think he's just trying to say, like, the dynamic doesn't work that way. And again, like, we've talked about this with teaching before, and there are, like, clear differences between analysis and teaching, but one of the things that where there's a structural similarity, if not maybe even an actual one, is that, like, it's important at the beginning of the semester for your students to think that you have something to teach them. It's not very good at the end of the semester if they think you know everything and they don't know anything. Because then they can't. In fact, they should go at the end of the semester and be like, okay, this person knows a lot about these things, and my interest has been sparked in these other things, which they are not expert in, and I recognize, like, that they're not expert in that.
Couldn't you even go further and go like, oh, that fool, I can know what that fool knows.
Yeah, that's fine. Right? That's
like,
fine.
You
yeah,
know,
yeah,
I,
yeah,
like, totally. I think that's, I think yeah. that's like the Platonic ideal. I'm wary of saying Platonic ideal about teaching, because he has a whole dialogue about
it. He's got a whole dialogue.
The Meno is all about that. But you know, isn't that the ideal of teaching, right? Like that after the semester or after they're leaving you, they're like, oh, I can just do that. Like, I don't, like, they've just read a lot of books. Like,
that's a good thing. Yeah, no, you want that. You want that. You know, so, but you need, but this is the thing, right? You need the buy-in. We've talked about this before. You need the buy-in at the beginning, but you and you also need to encourage the to transcend the situation, and so that it's not dependent on the other person, and that's what I think that's what Lacan's trying to get at. And, right. and that's where like why, you know, we're spending a lot of time talking about it, because it's like the, like interjecting this, philosophically sophisticated idea of the subject is what he is. I if you want to defend him, is what he's trying to,
I think
to
it's draw, his greatest contribution.
Out. Yeah.
Greatest nice. Contribution. Just
say
no,
more.
Just to me, just like that. No question about that, because he's the one, he's the only one. Freud had read Kant, but you know, in a kind of a passing way, and he hadn't read Hegel at all. It's very clear. He makes two references, both which show that he didn't know anything. And I don't say that as an insult. I mean, whatever. He just didn't. He didn't do it.
Yeah.
But Lacan, I mean, he knew Kant very well. He knew Kojève's Hegel, which is dicey, but okay. He knew Hegel really. I mean, he had read Hegel very carefully. So he, I think, was uniquely positioned. And there's just no one else, like Melanie Klein, Anna Freud. There's just all these other great figures in the history of psychoanalysis, Winnicott. They just didn't have that kind of, I mean, Fanon would be the next person. And he, yeah. But he dies when he's, I know he's 30, he's in his early 30s. So yeah. He's just has no time to do what Lacan did. So I think Lacan is the really uniquely positioned to introduce the problem of subjectivity into psychoanalysis. And then when that's what he does in this seminar more than anywhere else, right? More than anywhere else. And I think that he, as he's doing that, I think what he does is he shows that, okay, if you really want to understand subjectivity a la Kant and Hegel and the rest of German idealism, I don't think he read Fichte or Schelling, but okay, they're in there. If you really want to do that, you have to have the idea of the unconscious. And their understanding, I mean, Kant, Fichte, Hegel, Schelling, their understanding was limited, he would say, because they couldn't bring this idea of unconscious into subjectivity. And thus they missed how subjectivity always is in this position of the gap between, you know, this. He does this whole thing here on the way the unconscious is opening and closing. Right.
Yes.
And I think isn't it so great? Like he's really just saying, like, there's this moment when the unconscious opens, let's say when you have a slip, right? Or when you have a dream.
Right.
And then it just closes, because what do? You have a slip, you go, wow, that was a, so I had a friend of ours, I'm not going to out him, but he goes, okay. He said it was a great slip, and he apologized for it and was very, I don't think it was Freudian, but he goes, we'll just do this on our schedule because we want to take your feelings into consideration. But he meant to say on your schedule. Right?
Oh, that's really funny.
So it was, it was great. And but I mean, I don't think it was a Freudian, so it was just a slip. But
the typo, can we just talk about this for a second? Because the autocorrect is really interesting, because it's like, because I think the slip isn't the writing it. I guess I would say, like, maybe the slip is in not seeing that there's a mistake. Like I was texting with a friend of mine, hey Seth, and I wrote like something, maybe he didn't want me to talk about it, so I'll just in general terms, like he had something that was like a personal accomplishment, and I said, like, let's go out to dinner and toast you about it. Only that's not what it turns out I wrote to him. I wrote, let's go out to dinner and roast you about it. That's what came out.
That's great.
I in my head, toast. It's toast. Like I'm like, and I'm just doing like six other things. And so, and then I go back to it, and it's got the notification that he laughed about it. And I was like, why did he laugh about this? And then I saw that the text said roast. Like I had made this joke, and it was an autocorrect thing. But I would submit that where the slip is in there, it's not in me writing it, or maybe it is because I'm trying to.
But
to
it's
deny
in the
that.
Looking over it, and not
yeah, and not seeing
it.
I think that's sort of interesting. But it's
My favorite slip is the when you don't attach, right? So I'm giving a talk.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. You've done that to me before.
I'm giving a talk in Montreal in French. I don't think I've ever given a talk in. So I'm feeling a little, you know, terrified, whatever.
Yeah.
And I sent it to a friend, Louis Paul Willis, who listens to the show, I think.
Hey.
And I sent to Luke Paul and I'm like, you know, if, and he said, he offered, and he was like, I'll look over and make sure you're, you know, you're not, you don't sound like a total idiot. And I just forgot to attach it. So clearly I understood I was going to be exposing my own castration and I did not want it attached. Right. That's when the unconscious opens for Lacan, right? Like that's the idea. But then once you even say, see, I think this is the great idea that he has here, this pulsating the unconscious. Once you even say, oh, that's a Freudian slip, or, oh, what a slip, or anything like that.
Right, right.
It's already closed. You've already closed it, right? Like even this acknowledgement of the Freudian slip is already the closure of it. Right, like I've given this example many times before, but my college girlfriend, I insisted on using my high school girlfriend's name in reference to her. So she was furious, and I even told myself it's a Freudian slip. But even that telling myself, which avowed the fact that I still had desire for this other person and not for the person I was with so much, like that was itself already a way of closing of the unconscious, right? So it cannot stay, like this is Lacan's point, it cannot stay open. It cannot stay open.
Yeah.
Dreams
it's
too.
This is where, so I'm glad that you took this here, because this is the, like hooking in like the subjectivity as this important concept. So it's this, to be self-serving about it, what he's onto is we're subjects of the gap, and the unconscious makes these gaps in our in what would ordinarily be a smooth, what we would like to believe is a smooth psychic functioning, you know, like
exactly,
and that's what the short session is designed to try to punctuate is like there's where it is, please leave.
That this is the seminar he devotes most to the gaze. And again, so gaze is the objet A in the field of the visual, right? He says that right here. So
direct
it's one
quote.
Version of the objet A. Objet A is not a concept. Gaze is not a concept. But gaze gets more screen time in this seminar than any other concept, right? Yeah. Like it's kind of crazy. Like everybody that talks about the gaze, half the people don't understand it. Thanks in no small part to the incredible work of the translator of this seminar. But I'm sorry. I mean, Alan Sheridan's dead, so I apologize to his people that are his descendants, because I just think I was talking to somebody about this before. I hate attacks on translators because, like, I have this video that I've made because there's six competing translations of Hegel's Phenomenology. And three have come out in the last 5 years. And so I make a video going through each of them and saying which one I think is the best. And then I just can't. I haven't been able to publish it because I just think translation's so, I've done it for a couple of things. It's so thankless. And it just, your name probably isn't even on the cover. And no one, all people do is complain about it. No one likes, you know, it's just, I hesitate to say this, but really this is probably one of the most damaging translation efforts in human history. Right, like it's really.
Listen, I'm not laughing because I disagree with you. It's just, it's really just the whole setup of the
I know. I set it up just, to say
it's humor.
I'm not going to say anything bad about translation, but okay. It's like you know, there's the Nazi Holocaust, and then there's like Alan Sheridan's translation of 7R11.
Yeah,
right.
Quote like Todd McGowan. So I just before we get to that, I do want to say because we have done a. We've talked about this before. I think we did this as an aphorisms episode, but it's just important to say that in this seminar. So this is on the unconscious. The unconscious is constituted by the effects of speech on the subject. It is a dimension in which the subject is determined in the development of the effects of speech. Consequently, the unconscious is structured like a language. There you go. There's your big line on the unconscious.
Right.
And that's an important one. He clarifies later. We talked about this unconscious structure like a language. I think we did that some years ago. He wants to, and there's a nice.
Interestingly, this is the first time we said this in the episode where he directly says it like this.
Yeah. And he says later, right, I never said structured by a language,
right,
which is a really, really important point. Yeah. Like, and so structured like a language, just as we've been sort of teasing out, is that I think it's too psychically difficult to be conscious all the time about how, like, how subjective language is. Like, I have this, I need to write this somewhere, but Hugh Mannin knows this line, if he's listening, hey Hugh, all hearing is mishearing. That's my,
right,
you know, the extraction from Freud about, like, parapraxis. And it's just too difficult. But, like, I think the best that we can do when you're trying to explain yourself to other people or just to explain anything is that you can get 90% there. And like, yeah, like I've been thinking about,
that's for pretty,
like,
high. I think
it's pretty high. That would be pretty, yeah, high.
I know, I don't 50, think it's that high.
It's probably not. 51%, yeah, would be pretty good. Yeah, and I just been thinking, yeah, I've been thinking about for, like, the last, like, 35 minutes that, yeah, I was like, should I have clarified that the students are looking to see if the school is invested in the war machine? Is that, that's what, like, and I was like, you know what? Yeah. But, like, you just have to, I can't, you know,
yeah, you can't
do it.
That's right. No, you can't do it.
And there was a friend of mine said something, really, really funny to me once, I was talking about my podcast to somebody and they were like, oh wow, they should really listen to it. And I'm always like, to I don't know, to fellow faculty or whatever, I'm like really bashful about it. I'm like, no, don't listen to it. I was like, look, it's just, you don't have to do it. It's not, like, it's not perfect. Like, yeah, I'll, like, when I write things, it's like, that's better. And then my friend was like, no, your podcast is peer reviewed, just like everybody else's is. And I was like, okay, good point. Good point by you. I should. It's so, this was,
it actually, so the irony is, like, for me, this podcast is more peer reviewed than most things I do.
That's hilarious. Since
you get to a certain position, it's kind of crazy, man. Like, you get to a certain position, and, like, I just basically, nothing that I do is peer reviewed, I don't think. I think it's just, or I mean, it's in a most perfunctory way. Like, they just,
yeah,
you know, it's just, that's, it's funny. Because, I mean, that's, well, the whole.
And that's true, and that's, like, that's the gold standard. But yeah, anyway, since he said that, I've been less bashful, and I've been like,
good,
no, yeah, I'm proud. I'm proud of this work that you and I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, yeah, but my point on this. So that was a nice example of where somebody heard the right thing in what I said. They actually, like, they didn't listen to me.
Yeah. Good.
They heard the other thing. And again, nice little mundane example. And what Lacan, I think we must have talked about this in that episode. I'm not remembering it, but, like, what language has is all these gaps and fissures, because the languages were created by subjects. Now, we walk around all the day, all the time, like, every day, like, it's these, like, this objective structure that everyone understands. And you kind of have to think that it's the same thing. Just like you have to think the analyst has something to say about you, like, they have some insight, yeah, about you. Just like you have to think the professor has something to teach you at the start of the class. Like, you have to go out into the world and just be like, I'm going to use words and someone's going to have an at least functional understanding of what I'm saying, just, or, so I can get a loaf of bread when I,
right,
when
or
I ask
that the
for
world
it
is just out there.
Or right, that the world, I mean, is just that, nicely put.
That's,
sure,
that's where the gaze thing comes in, is a very interesting supplement to what you're saying, right? Like,
nice transition.
You can't, if you're seeing the gaze constantly, you'd be immobilized. Like, you, yeah, wouldn't be able, because what the gaze is you're, the way you're involved in what you're seeing, right? But, yes, most of the time,
yes,
you just go along thinking like, oh, I'm just seeing this thing, everything's external to me. It's not,
yeah,
like, no, they didn't build the grocery store just for me, right, did they? but in a certain sense, they did, right? They didn't make, sure, the film just for me, but they did. I mean, like that, like your desire, I know when you're at, I was just traveling across the country and I had the radical misfortune of being in a couple of AMC theaters.
And
it is the worst slam theater. It's incredible. I don't know how I remember when that stock got bought up.
Yeah,
what were those people thinking? They should have let AMC die. I mean, so let me just say,
you're
what
a regal
happens,
man, aren't you?
Oh, whatever, that's, anything.
All right.
but let me just tell you, it lasts like 25 minutes. I'm not kidding. 25 minutes. And then you get Nicole Kidman come up and say,
"Oh, you're right.
Oh, there's this magic in the theater." I'm like, "What? The magic's dead. It's dead. It's sucked out of me because I've already watched 25 minutes of ads and previews, and then on top of that, a 5-minute thing about how great AMC is, and I'm just, it is incredible." Like, it's funny because don't you think after the pandemic, there was this real concerted effort to say, okay, we're going to cut out all this ad crap and make theater going a real special thing again. And now that's completely, that's just out the window, totally out the window.
It's,
But you still watch the film and you're like, wait a minute, that's not just made for me, but that's I think that's the idea. So this is page 96 in the English edition. So this is it's key that it's in the English edition. So this is what Lacan says. No doubt in the depths of my eye, the picture is painted. The picture certainly is in my eye. And then we get Alan Sheridan's interesting edition, but I am not in the picture. Okay.
Right.
Okay. That sustains this idea that there's a kind of externality between me and what I'm seeing. But of course, in French, it says, mais moi, je suis dans le tableau. There's no je ne suis pas. There's no I am not. There's just I am in the picture. So he's saying the exact opposite. And I think that what Sheridan got thrown off by is the fact that sentence starts with a mais with a but. Mm-hmm. Right? Like because he says the picture is in my eye. Then he says, but. And so you think like, oh, so it has to be the opposite, but I'm not in. But no, he says, but I'm in the picture. So he just missed how the, I think that's what happened, right? That he missed how the contrast of the conjunction was working, I think. It has to be that, but I don't know.
And then it's not just the translation. It's just like, just read the next line. That which is light looks at me. And by means of that light in the depths of my eye, something is painted, something that is not simply a constructed relation, the object on which the philosopher lingers, but something that is an impression, the shimmering of a surface that is not in advance situated for me in its distance. So just that's the next sentence.
Yeah.
And it follows that, like, again, so this, recently become quite attached to the metaphor with the gaze is that you are not a lighthouse. Okay, you're not.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Can you explain them?
So the gaze in the psychoanalytic sense and in the Lacanian sense is you. It's not you are in this, like you're saying. Like you're in the theater is a good example of it too. Like you are this lighthouse that is it's disconnected from something else, and you are showing your light. You're shining your light on whatever it is you see, and that light never gets reflected back on you. So you just get to pick what you want to shine a light on, and that relationship is never reciprocal. So it's just like it's. I think this idea of the picture is in my eye, but I'm in the picture is one of the most politically potent ideas that Lacan has. That not just erases it completely. He just becomes an obscuritinist. He becomes someone who sounds like he would think that there is a big other, meaning like there is some position, you know, like there is some position outside of language or outside of representation that you can abscond and retreat to, and then you get in your little lighthouse, you get up at the top with the light, and then you see whatever, and then you're never in what you see. And that's the problem with that, is that you get in your lighthouse, you see whatever you want, and you're never a part of the problem. There's so many academics do this. I mean, it's not even like, I mean, it's one of those things, right, where it's like, Todd, how many people have hit more than 10 home runs in baseball? It's like, you can't even like begin to think about it.
Yeah,
like,
you couldn't count it.
It's probably the academic move that academics don't see most rubs people the wrong way, and they think when people have a bad reaction to whatever they say, they think it's about something else. But no, it's about pretending you're not a part of the thing that you are saying you like are against.
Isn't the most significant way that that's true is the analysis of like the Trumpian voter, right? Or Trumpism, right? Yeah. Like that the intellectual academic analysis of it is part of the phenomenon itself.
Yeah,
right. It's not separate from it. It's part of the. I mean, it's not like, oh, this is happening and then this is a reaction again. No. It's part of it. It's included within it, I think. And I think you're really right to point out how that kind of malady is very widespread. And understandably, it's hard to avoid, I think. I mean, I think there's something. I mean,
that's the whole point with the unconscious. He's been saying, like, that's what we're trying to thread right. through, I think, is that right. like what would you prefer to avoid is the yeah. is the gaze that the and yeah. this to be very clear the and to put hook this into my example of the lighthouse, the gaze is not on the side of the person you think is the gazer. The gaze is in the object. It's not on the side of the subject. That's the most important thing.
Right. It's the most important thing. Although it's the way that the subject's desire distorts what it sees, right?
Yes,
it is in the object, but it's actually the subject itself outside there in what it's looking at, right?
Yeah. Like it's an extimate relation. It'd been nice if he called that an extimate relation.
I know. It's just, it's too bad he uses the word. We talked about this in Seminar 7. He uses the term extimacy one time in Seminar 7, but this is where it really, I mean, this is where the concept really is, I think, manifest, right? Like the gaze is the extimate object, right? Like it's the point at which it's outside of us, and yet it's the way that our desire manifests itself out there. So I can see why he focused so much on the gaze in this seminar, because for one thing, he has a couple of cool little anecdotes, right? He has the Hans Holbein ambassador's picture, which is very obvious, I think, that mm-hmm. what he's talking about. And then he has this anecdote with this little guy. He's out fishing with this little guy, Petit Jean. And Petit Jean says to him, do you see that? There's a sardine can in the ocean bobbing up and down. He's like, do you see that can? You see it, but it doesn't see you. And mm-hmm. and Lacan goes, he found this anecdote amusing, me less so, which is a great, it's very funny, I think. But then he goes, actually some people that are invested in Lacan do not note what he says afterward, because what he says afterward is, but all the same, the can did see me.
Yes.
Right? Like his point is, crucial. Petit Jean was actually in, because Petit Jean was trying to say, you're nothing here in this picture. You don't belong, right? You're just this bourgeois who's down slumming it in the south of France. But let me just say, Lacan says, actually, I do belong, in the sense that my non-belonging is part of what I'm seeing in the visual field, right? Like you can't say like, you never have this totally external relationship to what you're seeing. That's his point, right? That's his point. And I think it's just such an amazing, and again here, I think this is part of his contribution to philosophy, right? And you said to mm-hmm. politics, which is evidently true, I think, right? Mm-hmm. Like the number of, I mean, why wasn't this concept understood in film theory? Why wasn't it? Because just think how radically it would have changed the way people understood how film was studied, how film theory operated, even it was mobilized in this bastardized way for feminist film theory, right? Like, what would feminist film theory, I mean, there, of course, there's the great example, we talk about her all the time, of Joan Kopczak, who's trying to rehabilitate this for her kind of feminist film theory, which didn't catch on, right? Mm-hmm. But what would it have been if that would have been the driving idea of the gaze, right? Then what's feminism? It's a much different idea of what feminism is, I think, than this male gaze of mastery.
So this is what you're getting at with the Petit Jean and the Holbein examples, is that there's these nice spots in the visual field in each one, where the mastery of the viewer is subverted, and there's this spot where there is, as opposed to what Petit Jean says, it's not that there's a thing, you see it but it doesn't see you, but rather there's this thing there and it sees you before you see it.
Right.
And the sardine can sees you before you see it. The skull in the ambassadors sees you before you see it. And like, that's just like one way of thinking about the gaze as that point that is the index of where your mastery over the image fails. You know, like what's his name? Perry it's not Perry? Is it Perry Mason? No, it's not Perry Mason in Vertigo. Why am I forgetting his name? The guy
Scotty.
Scott? No. Not the guy who killed his wife.
God, I've forgotten. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's totally fine.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's so when Scotty's looking across the courtyard, and then
in rear window, it's not Scotty. It's I thought you said Vertigo.
It's
Raymond Burr. That's why you thought it was Perry Mason.
That's why I said Perry Mason.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Jeff in Rear Window. What's the guy's name in the across Thorwald?
Thorwald.
Lars
okay.
Thorwald.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I was all over the shop for the last 2 minutes there. But so the point is, in the correct film and the correct actor, is that there's that moment, that terrifying moment where Stewart, Jimmy Stewart's character, I'm just gonna go with that because I know that's him, is looking across the courtyard, and he sees the man he's been suspecting of murder the whole time, like, look back at him, and it's terrifying to be looked at like that, like, because you think, just like Jimmy Stewart does in that film, you think that you get to see the image and the image doesn't see you.
Right.
And
right.
like you think, just like Petitjean, like, you see that guy across the courtyard, you see him, he doesn't see you.
And he doesn't care about you.
No, right. It's actually you, when you recognize you're being looked at, it's too late. You've already been seen, you know, right. That's the thing. So that's the idea that Lacan is trying to get at with the gaze and objet A is, like, again, you think you it all follows, right? Like, you think you know what you want, but it's something else. You think you see something and it doesn't see you, but it saw you first. Like, that's right. Like that's how it is. And your failure, the failure of your gaze to master what you're looking at, is already included in the object.
Because
go ahead.
Now, I was just going to say, sorry, because your subjectivity and your unconscious distorts the way you look, right? And mm-hmm. distorts the field of the visible.
That's right.
Or any field of perception. Because objet A is not just the visual, right? There's a voice
right.
as well. So I think that's really, really crucial, that distortion of subjectivity. And that's how everything's actually linked together for Lacan. This seminar really, I mean, he is obviously talking about, we've said he's talking about four different concepts and he thinks he's talking about, but it does follow a real through line, I think. And, and I think it's really about this subjectivity and the unconscious and how all the different variegations of that, right? Like, I think that's what he's really trying to explore here, maybe more than anywhere else, right?
I agree. I mean, and I think it's such a powerful idea, right? That your subjectivity distorts the visual field. I try to go over these examples. I do think this is so much easier for people to get with mishearing than it is with misseeing. And I think that's part of why, Jones' rehabilitation of this version of the gaze, like, why it didn't really catch on, because I do think that, like, we are a lot more psychically invested in being like, oh, look, I might mishear something from time to time, but, like, I don't missee things.
I know what I'm seeing
very rarely.
I'm going to tell everyone what you do. You played the song called Ice Blink Luck, which is a great song by the Cocteau Twins. And you asked the students to tell them what the lyrics to the song are, which is an impossible task. Even if you can't even tell the lyrics if you have the lyrics in front of your face. And one of the things is interesting, if you look online for the lyrics, they're like, it's either this or this.
And sometimes they're wrong. Yeah, it's really funny. Yeah, yeah.
It's great. Yeah.
You're the mad one, choke cherry coal.
I know. But I know. It's a group that both of us quite like. But least for their use of the voice as an object.
Yeah, they totally do.
Yeah, I think that this is that gaze. I think what's nice that we're seeing is the way that everything kind of fits, right? Like, subjectivity, mm-hmm. unconscious, gaze, and then desire drive, I think, is this final piece of the puzzle. I want to, I love this. This is one of my favorite lines from Lacan. This is on 166 in the English.
Yeah.
He says, it's clear that those with whom we deal, the patients, are not satisfied, as one says, with what they are. And yet, we know that everything they are, everything they experience, even their symptoms, involves satisfaction. Let us say that for this satisfaction, they give themselves too much trouble. Up to a point, it is this too much trouble that is the sole justification of our intervention. So I think what I love about this is I think this is his maybe most complex justification for what psychoanalysis does. Mm-hmm. And also articulation of the drive, because I think what he's saying is, look, the drive satisfies itself, right? And so it doesn't matter. The drive isn't repressed. And I think that's a key, like ideas can be repressed. Desires can be repressed. Drive isn't repressed. And that's why he's saying, look, someone comes into us, they seem dissatisfied. But then he says, we know that everything they experience involves satisfaction. Right. And so I think that that to me is really gets at what he's, how he's considering drive, right? Like that drive is this, is what satisfies us, what keeps us, you know, he says, I think there's a link between the affect associated, or let me just put it this way. I think the affect associated with drive is enjoyment or jouissance, right? And then he says, this is a very famous statement in I think it's in the Subversion of the Subject and the Dialect of Desire, right? This late écrit. I think he says something like, jouissance is that without which life would not be worth living, right? And I think that's, that drive is such that you can't even, like it gives us the satisfaction that allows us to go on, right? So it's not like, oh, my life sucks. I teach at the University of Vermont. It's so oppressive. It's terrible. You know, of course, it's not true. It's like the greatest place to teach there is. As I was taking this tour in the Midwest, I was like, oh my God, thank God. I shouldn't say that. I went to Indiana University and it was surprisingly beautiful and impressive.
Take that, Notre Dame.
I know, but you know, then they, you know what everyone said though? They're like, yeah, Bloomington's great, but it's in Indiana. So I thought that was a, I didn't know what to make of that. Anyway, I think that that base level for Lacan satisfaction, that's drive for him, right? That's what keeps us, you get up in the morning, you keep doing the things you do, no matter how seemingly dissatisfying your life is, right? Mm-hmm. And if you didn't have the satisfaction, the drive, there's an easy way out for everyone. I think that's the idea, right? That's the idea.
Yeah. No, yeah. I think that's true. I also want to say very quickly, when I play that song for my students, like 80% of the room hears the line that I said as cherry cola. It nicely makes the
I have to tell you that I even know the proper lyric, and I still, when I'm singing it to myself in the car, hopefully no one has seen me singing this song to myself in the car, I say the wrong thing.
That's right. It's the best Mondegreen in pop music as far as I'm concerned.
A phenomenal song too.
It's a phenomenal song.
Phenomenal.
That's the lesson. Lesson is listen to the Cocteau Twins. I think it's probably better than anything else we could come up with for this particular episode. I think this idea, this point of satisfaction is, to talk like a podcaster on like a pop culture, series. This is really underrated, Todd. It's really satisfaction is an underrated term. I think people don't talk about
it. I agree.
Because because jouissance or enjoyment is just a lot. It just seems like there's more there. There's certainly more written about it. And so satisfaction.
For sure.
Satisfaction seems like, maybe it just seems really simplistic. It's about as complicated as the Rolling Stones make it for us, right? You just can't get none. Like that's it. Right. But I think that
Lacan's anti Rolling Stones on this.
He's anti Rolling Stones in this regard. And that, wait a minute. When did this come out? What was this? 60?
63, 64.
Well, I think maybe early singles. Anyway, it doesn't matter. That there's.
Oh, that'd be great if he was really commenting on that.
If he was really commenting. Yeah. No, that song wasn't out yet, but that would be hilarious. So, yeah. I like this idea of talking about.
They were commenting on Lacan.
Clearly, yeah. Keith Richards definitely seems like the kind of guy who is desperate to get the English translations of French philosophy in the early 60s. I think he needed to get it. Like he was first in line. So what I've been kind of circling around that I want to get to with this is that something you and I have talked about a lot, and like what this seminar is really important at getting to, is this relationship between desire and drive. Because sometimes, I mean, we get these questions from listeners sometimes, and it's a good question because it's not always clear. It's just people will just ask, my students will ask, listeners will write in and ask, what is the distinction between desire and drive? Because like they'll read something somewhere and be like, okay, I thought I understood that, you know, the drive always undermines you. And so like I understand that part. And then I understand that desire like always fails and that like and desire can't be satisfied. So like the way that the one thing works sounds an awful lot like the way the other thing works.
Right.
Can you explain their interrelation or the distinction? And part of the I do think that I don't think it's conscious, but I do think that sometimes these two ideas do seem very similar.
I think there is even an argument that maybe they shouldn't even be distinct.
Yeah.
I think that's not a crazy argument, actually.
The only thing I would say is I think that like
use your example, because I think your metaphor here is pretty great.
Thanks. Thank you. Appreciate that. So what I tell when I talk about this is that like the drive has no destination. That's flatly. Drive has no destination. It's more like the engine in a car, and it's just like it's just gonna go. It's gonna go no matter what. The engine's gonna run no matter what. But what you need is some like if you have some idea where you're gonna go, and that concept of a destination, that's desire. And then certainly, like when you get there, wasn't enough. You went out to, I don't know, Coachella that's happening this weekend. I don't know, wasn't as fun as you thought it was going to be. It's just really, really hot because it's the desert. You totally didn't even think about that. It's just the desert. Like it is just the desert. I'm going to say it like three times because it's just the desert. And so you're the desire in this scenario, unsatisfied, but you know what was not? That engine got out. It was purring, baby.
Yeah.
And and it was able to get exactly what it is purposed with, like the purpose was fulfilled for the drive.
I mean, I think there's something like you could say maybe it's the difference, but I mean they follow the same path, that's for sure.
They follow the same path. The car metaphor is pretty good because you get in it, you have to go somewhere, but like the drive doesn't care about the destination.
Right.
Destination is more the provenance of desire, and then that's not gonna be satisfying when you get there.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, that's the key thing, right? So I think that it's something like the difference between self-destruction and failure, right? Like I think that may be one other, this was kind of, I mean, I'm just sort of putting into conceptual terms what your metaphor was saying, right? Like I think that that's the, or I mentioned metaphor. It's also the difference between metaphor and metonymy.
Metonymy,
right? Like, desire is metonymous. Like it goes from one object to another object to another object, whereas drive is just this metaphorical constant movement of the same.
But this is the thing. But this is important, and I think this helps with this example as well. Is that we all the time get wrapped up in thinking, but this desire will not be metonymy.
I know
it will be.
And that's why they're basically the same, right?
Yeah.
So they're the same, except desire keeps putting an object out there, and drive doesn't care about that. And but desire keeps following the same path of the drive. Right. So the metonymy of desire is a kind of a fake.
Yeah.
Right. It's a fake because you think like everyone has had this happen. Okay. Except maybe incels or whatever, but everyone else has had this happen. Right. Like you break up with one romantic partner and then you start with a new one. You're like, ha, thank God I don't have all those same. And then you're like, wait a minute. It's all exactly the same kind of thing.
because you're the same asshole.
The realm of romance.
That's part of the to go back to the gays point, because you're this, because also you had some part in why that previous thing wasn't so great.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Right. I mean, you can make it about friends too. Like why does my friendships keep having the same trajectory? Why is this?
Yeah. Why does exactly? Yeah.
I don't know. I always seem to pick the wrong one.
Right. Exactly.
Foiled again.
Yes. Yeah.
I think it's, you know, like, if it wasn't for you meddling kids.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, I think that's really, that's what makes the path the same, right? Like, yeah. The path has to be considered the same. So that's why I think, in a way, that the distinction does a disservice. You know, who's very good about this, I think, is Alenka Zupančič in Ethics of the Real, because she really,
that's nice.
I think, she doesn't say exactly what we just said, but she theorizes this relationship between, because she's trying to think of how ethics of desire that Lacan develops, because I've never talked about ethics of the drive, but she tries to link those two things together, ethics of desire to like moving into the drive. And it's a great book, I think, actually. Which is, you can almost say that's a pleonism, right? Like that Alenka Zupančič wrote a great book.
That's a great point for you.
To say the other point. Right. Yeah. So anyway, so that's, I think, the key thing. I just want to say, before we leave the terrain of I know we have the great Ice Blink Luck example, but I think there is true. A film that manages to capture every single one of these concepts almost perfectly. So it's this film by Abbas Kiarostami, which I think is his, this is going to sound terrible because it's his Western film, and I'm going to say, I think it's his masterpiece. So he's a great Iranian director, just died, I don't know, 7 years ago or something. Great Iranian director. But he made this film in France or Italy, maybe Italy. But
it's in Italy, I think, by
Canal Plus, I think, funded it. Mm-hmm. And it's called Copie Conforme. The title's in French, too. Copie Conforme, translated as Certified Copy. And it's with Juliette Binoche. What's the guy's name? He's an opera star, I think, right?
I don't know the name of his actor. His name's Miller in the thing.
James Miller is his name in the... I kept thinking he's the guy that wrote the... Oh, that's James Miller that wrote the Foucault biography.
That's really funny.
It's not him, no.
It's a fictional person.
It's a fictional person, yeah. But it doesn't seem like at first they have a relationship. So she comes to his, he's giving a talk about this book that he's written about copies, the reproductions, in art, basically. And she comes and starts to interview him. They drive in her car. And then it all of a sudden... And it seems like they don't know each other, but maybe they do, and it's not ever clear. And then all of a sudden, they have this encounter in a little cafe. And then from that moment on, it seems like they actually have been married and have a child together. She has a child that we see at different points in the film. And that they have a child together, and that they've had this terrible split up or fight or something, and that they're trying to deal with the aftermath of it, and they're returned. So there's a nice repetition to the town where they, is it the town where they got married or the town where they,
yeah,
I don't know, well, honeymooned, I mean, or honeymoon something. Yeah. But it's incredible. And what's great about it is you never know, like, is this the original or is this the repetition? And Kiarostami is trying to say that it's actually the repetition. This is for him. I mean, this is maybe the idea in all of his films, right? The repetition that constitutes the original. And what it grabs is the subject's desire, because you're constantly seeing what do I desire in this? Like, do I want them to be already a couple, or do I want this to be? And you're constantly struggling with this question. And then there's this incredible shot around a fountain where... Oh, yeah. Do you remember this shot? This is one of the most visually arresting moments in the history of cinema, I think. And they're both kind of disappearing out of our sight. And so, again, he's using like their absence from the visual field to signify the way that that's where our desire is located. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's just, and it ends in this incredible, there's actually a mirror. We've talked about Joan Kopchak's famous line that the screen isn't a mirror. This is her anti-traditional film theory line. The screen isn't a mirror. The mirror is a screen. And that's never been better illustrated than at the final shot of this film. Yes, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree completely. I mean, yeah, and if you want to, the screen for desire, right, would be the finish the
for sure.
Yeah, and which like, and I go over this all the time. Like one of the most everyday mundane, just things that we do, like where we take a piece, the most mundane bad synecdoche that we all do is that you see yourself in the mirror. How you look in the mirror before you leave, that's how you look for the rest of the day. And not only is that, it doesn't really matter if that is how you appear to other people, because you look at yourself with subjectivity and you're like, ugh, I hate this about myself, or I like this, or like whatever. And like other people are not going to notice that, and they don't see you that way.
They don't even notice that.
So it's not even that part, but like also the mirror is you reversed. So all day, most days, your idea of how you look is reversed.
It's amazing. I know. And remember when Zoom first started, there was this whole thing because it didn't mirror you.
It didn't mirror you. And then that had to be added.
It was too confusing for people.
It was the mirror stage comes back.
I remember like I would be adjusting my hat and I couldn't adjust it correctly. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm making it more wrong.
Right. So what happened, just for people who didn't do Zoom University for 2 years in the pandemic or Zoom teaching younger grades or whatever, because obviously that's how everything was. The way that Zoom would, which was the interface that my college used in a lot of places. There was like Microsoft Teams or whatever. There are all kinds of other ones.
Teams did the same thing, I think, though. So
Teams did the same.
Yeah.
So what it did was when you saw your image of yourself, it was flipped to the way, or not, I shouldn't say flipped. That's already a bit of a slip.
No, it's exactly how the other sees you.
It's exactly how the other sees you, which to you is flipped from how you normally see yourself. And so then what they had to do was make it the default to mirror you the way you see yourself in a mirror, but not the way that other people see you.
Because they saw the gaze in themselves, right?
Yeah.
It was just crazy. It's crazy. Yeah. I noticed you did say that there are things that you like about your looking at yourself. I'm happy that you said that, because all I see is things that just make me want to, I look in the mirror, I just want to vomit.
I hate to make it about this, but like my hair is very long right now, and I know I'm not trying to give you hair envy, but I don't leave the house unless I've even made, it's just like so shallow. I've even made myself late for class one day because I was like, I cannot leave this bathroom unless my hair is in a way that I can look at it and I can say, I like the way that this looks, like at least a little bit.
Interesting.
Like I can't, because maybe that isn't so shallow, because it's a more positive spin on saying, I hate the way that I look, and I'm not leaving until I can stand it.
I mean, I don't ever have that problem. My hair is just gone for good.
I think you should bring the stash back. I know I keep telling you this, but that's...
I can't do that. I can't do that.
All right. Someday.
No. I hate facial hair.
What about for my birthday?
No, I can't do it, man. Sorry. All right. Sorry. Just
I've only
itches.
Got one it's, a year.
I know. Sorry. All right. But let's end with the fascinating ending in the last section, right? Like, and Mollier nicely titles it "In You More Than You," which is the status of the objet A. And he has this kind of incredible passage where he says, this is on, let's see what it's on here, page 275 toward the end. He goes, he's talking about the drama of what he calls the drama of Nazism. And then he goes, mm-hmm. I would hold that no meaning given to history, based on Hegeliano Marxist premises is capable of accounting for this resurgence, which is Nazism, which mm-hmm. only goes to show, so it's like 19 years after the end of the World War II, he's saying this, which only goes to show that the offering to the obscure gods of a object of sacrifice is something to which few subjects can resist succumbing, as if under some monstrous spell. Ignorance, indifference, with an averting of the eyes may explain beneath what veil this mystery remains, beneath what veil this mystery still remains hidden. But for whoever is capable of turning a courageous gaze towards this phenomenon, and once again, there are certainly few who do not succumb to the fascination of the sacrifice in itself. The sacrifice signifies that, in the object of our desires, we try to find evidence for the presence of the desire of the other, of this other, that I call here the dark god. So I think, and then he references Spinoza again, so he's kind of coming full circle and saying maybe Spinoza is the only one that resists with his notion of the intellectual love of God. But I think this is really, I think it's such a lesson, like you said, the ultimate political lesson of this seminar is the gaze thing, and I think that's true for a leftist politics. But I think for an analysis of what we're witnessing today, this like incredible resurgence around the world of reactionary fascistic movements, right? Like it seems like that this is the point where he really is getting at that, right? Like he's saying this love of this enjoyment of sacrifice no progressive understanding of history can explain it, because it's that there's this spell that occurs in the act of sacrifice. And I think that's really, I don't know, I find this really powerful as a way to end. And I think it interestingly ties to the excommunication as the beginning, right? Like that.
Yeah.
Like certain subjects are sacrificed so that there's a structure of desire that can be put into place, right? Like I think ultimately that's one of his lessons, is that sacrifice is not just this thing. It's very anti-Agamben, right? Like Agamben is all this, like they could be killed, but they can't be set. He's very much against the logic of a sacrificial logic, right? But I think Lacan thinks, no, actually, you want to understand how society works, especially these extreme rightist movements, you have to understand the role that sacrifice plays in the structure of desire, right? Like, doesn't the whole point, even of desire or of drive, like, isn't the point that sacrifice is the very thing that gives us something to desire? That there's not, that there's something essential about it for that reason. In his mind.
And you would say, like, I think this would be the further political point, is that the more that that's not, the more that that is this, like the subtext of history or the subtext of politics, the more that it is allowed to perpetuate. And it
needs
to be the text. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right.
That's what he's saying. Like a progressive theory of history leaves it. That way. Yes. Now, obviously, we would want to redeem Hegel.
Hegel's not
as a retroactive thing.
He's like not a progressive, exactly kind of right? Right. Yeah, he's just wrong. I mean, this is a whole Kojevian reading and Marxian influenced reading, but it's wrong about Hegel. But I do think that I actually think he's right that Hegel has trouble. Hegel would have trouble understanding fascism. Like, I don't think
as it was happening. I think that's
I think he wouldn't.
Yeah, I think that's right. True.
I don't think his theory is great on that. So I think that I don't think Lacan's totally wrong. But I think this is just one of his greatest statements, really. I just think it's so smart because, and what you said is just really the perfect touch, because if you don't foreground sacrifice of yourself, then you're going to sacrifice someone else, right? Then you're like that's what isn't Nazism, this refusal of we're going to create a solid German identity that doesn't involve any sacrifice on our own. So we're going to who are we going to impose the sacrifice on? Communists and Jews, right? Like that's the, they're going to pay the price for that German jouissance. Right.
Right.
So I think that's the, incredible lesson, really, of the seminar. That and I think it really comes around from this excommunication to how that excommunication works, like how certain whole groups of people get excommunicated, right?
Yes, and that also brings us back, not to put too fine a point on it, to how I started this thing, but
that's correct.
I've already right. already said perhaps to we'll I hope that my employer is committed to academic freedom as much as it says that it is, but we'll so we'll see yeah, we'll see about that.
If you can always come live with me when you're fired. We'll get you some classes here.
There we go. Yeah. Okay. That sounds great.
Yeah.
So what's the lesson, Tom McGowan?
I think the lesson, Ryan, has to be watch Certified Copy with a little codicil of listen when you have the chance to ice blink luck, because it's both are well worth your time. I do want to say one thing. I want to add, I have to amend my very ethnocentric This Is Kiarostami's Masterpiece, because Close Up is a great, great film, which is made in Iran.
So it's
better. So I have a personal prejudice in favor of Certified Copy. I think Close Up probably objectively is the greater film. So
okay.
Okay.
All right. Oh, awesome. Amazing.
Over and out, Ryan.
Over and out, Todd.